Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 97, The Freud-Jung Letters. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
But the major thing he had done, and the work that he continued throughout his life to credit as his most important insight, was the interpretation of dreams. And Jung apparently got a hold of one of the 200 first copies published of that book and read it thoroughly, along with some of Freud's clinical papers. And so he showed up as a very well-informed, 20 years younger clinician, already at a doctoral level. He'd been working in Switzerland rather than in Austria. He'd been working at a well-known, probably the best-known Swiss psychiatric hospital, and he worked under the direct supervision of Eugen Bleuler, who did the most important work in defining schizophrenia as a psychological illness. So Freud comes from the realm of neurosis and neurology, and Jung comes from the realm of treatment of psychosis and, to some extent, of a more standard psychology. His doctoral thesis had been a study of word association. And so he actually had some experimental data from normal people giving their own associations to common lists of words that resonated with Freud's clinical data on association in the unusual setting of psychotherapy. So for a whole variety of reasons, the two men were very drawn to each other. The story is that Jung stayed with the Freuds and that the two men stayed up most of the night talking. And by the end of the night, were convinced, I think, in each case that they'd found a kind of soulmate. And you can sense in the letters a lot of mutual admiration and a readiness to make this a lasting friendship.
That was the voice of my longtime friend, Dr. Douglas A. Davis, who recently retired from full-time teaching at Haverford College in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, where he was professor of psychology and for many years department chair. Now, longtime listeners will remember Dr. Davis from Shrink Wrap Radio number 15 on Islamic psychology and number 42 on Happy Birthday, Dr. Freud. Among his many interests, Doug is a Freud scholar, and he's also one of the most interesting conversationalists it's ever been my pleasure to know. As you listen to the interview, I think you'll see what I mean. Dr. Doug Davis, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you. It is a pleasure to be here. I feel quite at home.
Well, you should. It's your third visit, and I think the last time is almost a year to the day. I was just kind of looking at it in my notes, and I think it was about a year ago. So that was too long.
Because we were celebrating Freud's birthday.
Exactly, exactly.
Which, if you believe the dominant theory about his birth, had happened in May in 1856. There are a few people who think it's March, which would cause him to have been conceived out of wedlock. But that's right. It was May a year ago, or early June or something.
Oh, well, that would make Freud and me birthday brothers, since I'm born in May as well. So maybe we're both Tauruses, and that accounts for our mutual genius.
No doubt, and explains other deep synchronistic ties between the two of you.
Yeah. Now, speaking of Freud, we're going to be speaking of Freud today, and you know, I know that you're a Freud scholar and that you have recently done some work on the Freud-Jung letters, their correspondence over a period of years. And I've read an article that you gave me a link to, and I'll put a link to that on this show site, if I may do so.
Absolutely.
And, boy, I learned a lot from reading that article that I didn't know. And so I'm really looking forward to us having an opportunity to share that with listeners. The title of your article is interesting. It's called Oedipus Redivivus, Freud, Jung, and Psychoanalysis. So the place for me to start is, what the heck does Redivivus mean?
Well, it's been a long time since my high school Latin, but I think it probably would be Redivivus. And it really means brought back to life. And it's one of those words that can cut a lot of different ways. It could mean, you know, kind of a physical resuscitation. But often in literature, it means something that causes the strongest reminiscence or re-evokes old material. And what I'm alluding to, as I'll try to explain as we talk, is the idea that Freud was very focused on at the point that his friendship with Jung was developing, that the most basic process of psychological development in childhood had a lot to do with the so-called Oedipus complex, in which the little child tries to imagine the relationship with that the parents have with each other and feels jealousy and anger and so on, often focusing on lustful urges toward the parent of the opposite sex and aggressive ones toward the rivalrous parent of the same sex. And as somebody who read this article in its published version commented, I'm trying to do a kind of psychoanalytic reading of the Freud-Jung correspondence, which went on over a period of years. And I think to both of them, particularly as the tensions began to grow toward the end of the relationship, both of them began to see this in somewhat Oedipal terms. Freud as another confirmation of how hard it was for his followers to outgrow their childish desires, and Jung as an all-too-revealing example of Freud's tendency to shoehorn everything into his theory and to treat his colleagues as if they were his patients.
Okay, well, I think you've really jumped into it with both feet and just given us a lot of the punchline here. But so let me back you up. And by the way, I notice you say Oedipal and I say Oedipal. Have I been saying it wrong all these years?
No, I think either one is okay. Again, I have no idea what Sophocles would have said, although I probably know people who could have. I think Oedipus is actually a more common pronunciation, but I hear Oedipus, and at some point I just dropped into that side of the loop.
Okay.
I think it's whatever works.
Okay, great. Well, maybe you could start out by kind of setting the backdrop for us of what, you know, what Europe was like for Freud and for Jung at the time that they met. Here's Freud in Vienna. Here's Jung coming out of Switzerland. Can you give us kind of briefly a sense of the flavor of the time?
Yes. The friendship between Freud and Jung lasted roughly 6 years, from 1906 to 1912.
Oh, so short. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Jung had already, as I'll say a little more about in a minute, Jung had already read quite a lot of Freud's work, and it was one of the things that impressed Freud tremendously when he appeared in Vienna and the correspondence began in 1906. And they continued to know each other and to be concerned with each other for the rest of their respective lives, Freud until 1939 and Jung until 1961. But the friendship is striking, like some other Freud friendships too, is striking for the speed with which Freud embraces Jung and they become very close, as revealed by their correspondence, and then the relatively rapid unraveling a few years later. So when Jung comes to see Freud, Freud is 50 years old. He has celebrated his 50th birthday with the first group of people who called themselves psychoanalysts, and they are colleagues of Freud's, mostly from the city of Vienna. They're people who he either knew directly through his medical training or his medical practice, and who have been influenced by his early work. Now, that early work included, by the end of the 1990s, several papers on the treatment of the neuroses. And Freud had become convinced by 1896 that many of the common neuroses, such as hysteria, where a person has little insight into their own emotional life and often rapid, what we sort of mean popularly by hysterical, rapid changes in mood and so on. Nothing as profound as a mania or a depression, but a sort of a neurotic style. And obsession, on the other hand, a kind of over-conscientiousness about trying to think one's way out of anxiety-causing situations. Freud had become convinced by 1896 that, based on his own treatment of patients, in one case he reports 13 patients and another one I think 18 that year, he's been using his what becomes the psychoanalytic method, where you're encouraged by your physician to associate to the circumstances of your present life. So I'm really angry with my boss. Well, what are you angry about? Well, he always treats me this way, this way. Well, has this ever happened before? Well, I've had other bosses like this, and I guess I had a teacher. And well, my dad was kind of tough on me. And then we begin talking about the father. And Freud had become convinced that these adult neuroses were the delayed result in response to relatively minor things that happened in early adulthood, such as the stress of a new job or the stress of maintaining an intimate relationship with a newly married spouse, that anxieties would be reawakened that evoked this forgotten, this repressed childhood trauma. And that Oedipal theory was very much on his mind. In fact, he had just published in 1905, after shortly before Jung visited him, his three essays on the theory of sexuality, where he outlines his so-called Freudian psychosexual theory of oral and anal and phallic phenomena. And he had published in the same year the case of Dora, which was his most thoroughgoing, up to that time, attempt to show how his psychoanalytic method worked. But the major thing he had done, and the work that he continued throughout his life to credit as his most important insight, was the interpretation of dreams. And Jung apparently got a hold of one of the 200 first copies published of that book and read it thoroughly, along with some of Freud's clinical papers. And so he showed up as a very well-informed, 20 years younger clinician, already at a doctoral level. He'd been working in Switzerland rather than in Austria. He'd been working at a well-known, probably the best-known Swiss psychiatric hospital. And he worked under the direct supervision of Eugen Bleuler, who did the most important work in defining schizophrenia as a psychological illness. So Freud comes from the realm of neurosis and neurology, and Jung comes from the realm of treatment of psychosis and, to some extent, of a more standard psychology. His doctoral thesis had been a study of word association. And so he actually had some experimental data from normal people giving their own associations to common lists of words that resonated with Freud's clinical data on association in the unusual setting of psychotherapy. So for a whole variety of reasons, the two men were very drawn to each other. The story is that Jung stayed with the Freuds and that the two men stayed up most of the night talking, and by the end of the night were convinced, I think in each case, that they'd found a kind of soulmate. And you can sense in the letters a lot of mutual admiration and a readiness to make this a lasting friendship. So just to tell the whole story very quickly, and then we can get into what the details might mean. Within a year or so, Freud's Vienna colleagues are hearing a great deal, probably more than many of them wish to, because in some ways they are a rivalrous band competing for the master's affection.
Yes.
About this marvelous new disciple, who I think they must have felt was somehow smarter and more creative and possessed of knowledge they didn't have. And Freud was, although the psychoanalytic movement basically consisted of meetings on Wednesday nights in his own apartment, Freud was already thinking about this as a much larger movement. And he saw Jung as someone who could bring the Swiss on board. He saw the contact with the Berkeley Hospital and with Bleuler's work as good for the prestige of psychoanalysis. And he was also, I think, attracted, as the letters reveal, he was attracted by Jung's different background. Jung was the son of a Swiss Reformed pastor, so he came from a Protestant Christian background. Freud's Vienna followers were all Jewish. And in fact, at one point in explaining to them why Jung is going to be so helpful to the movement, Freud says, you know, we are all Jews, and if psychoanalysis were to continue on this basis, we could be condemned as a quote-unquote Jewish science.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of chilling phrase because, of course, that's exactly what the Nazis did say about psychoanalysis. And indeed, although I don't consider myself an expert about it, and it would take us too far afield, one of the things that happens to prevent any rapprochement between Freud and Jung, or indeed the Freudians and the Jungians in the 1930s, is that Jews are forced out of German-speaking academic life, and Jung takes over the editorship of one of the journals. And from a Jungian point of view, he tried to attenuate the damage being done to Jewish academics, but I think from the point of view of Freud sympathizers and a lot of people who have studied Holocaust history, any collaboration with the Nazis really was a major problem. But at the period that they were close together, Jung went rapidly from being a sophisticated reader of Freud's ideas who had some doubts and was eager to be further educated by Freud, to being comfortable, I think, in the role of the kind of heir apparent of the movement. And he's very rapidly elevated to a position of international prominence. And then in 1909, Freud and Jung and one of Freud's other most devoted and interesting disciples, with whom there's also a long-published correspondence, Sándor Ferenczi, who was Hungarian, traveled at the invitation of G. Stanley Hall, the famous American psychologist, to Clark University, which was celebrating its own 50th anniversary. And they gave professional presentations, both Freud and Jung did, on psychoanalytic work. And that's really the first public airing of psychoanalytic views in the United States. And it's after that that tensions begin to develop between Freud and Jung, and they seem to focus around Jung's desire to incorporate into psychoanalytic theory some of the uniquely Jungian ideas, the ideas we now associate with Jung, about the long course of human history and the way that our species history influences our individual history.
Mm-hmm.
And what Jung sees as broadening the evidential base of psychoanalysis, making it more relevant to history and to culture, topics that Freud is quite interested in, as evidenced by his own publications in the teens, basically, begins to make Freud uneasy because it seems to Freud that Jung is allowing people to believe that they've embraced psychoanalysis without coming to terms with the difficulties of acknowledging everyone's psychosexual hang-ups, which is probably way too much information at this point.
Not at all. It's all very fascinating. And so let me think of how. So when they first met one another, what was their assessment of one another? I think you alluded to that a bit, that how did Freud see Jung and how was Jung looking at Freud?
Well, it's clear that that Freud, as he told his family and his colleagues, thought Jung was an unusually talented young disciple and someone who understood him well and deeply. And it's interesting, the correspondence, I should say, by the way, that there's enough published Freud correspondence to occupy several years if one wanted to go that route. But it's only in the case of Jung that the correspondence has been carefully edited from both points of view. So Jungian scholars and Freudian scholars agreed that this correspondence was very important for both movements. And the letters have been very carefully presented in the 1974 volume by McGuire that I use heavily in the paper you mentioned. And Jung is says in the letters things like what he said in his own publications about the time. For example, he writes a preface to his own Psychology of Dementia Praecox, which was the, it literally means sort of premature loss of higher mental functioning, which was the name given to the condition that Bleuler renamed schizophrenia. And Jung talks about his fascination with psychoanalysis, and this is in 1906, so it's at the beginning of the friendship, and he says, "I can assure the reader that in the beginning I naturally entertained all of the objections that are customarily made against Freud in the literature." And then goes on to say that I don't attribute to the infantile sexual trauma the significance that Freud does, but still less does it mean that I place sexuality so predominantly in the foreground or that I grant it the psychological universality, and Freud's therapy is only one of several therapies. So that's the cautious side of Jung. On the other hand, we find him writing to Freud a couple of years later, after he's heard Freud present data on one of his famous clinical cases, the so-called rat man, "I am still under the reverberating impact of your lecture, which seemed to me perfection itself. All the rest was merely padding, sterile twaddle in the darkness of inanity." So Jung knew how to administer a compliment, and Freud was hungry for that sort of thing. But the other thing I should say, and I don't really discuss it in any detail in the article you mentioned, which I should say, by the way, is a chapter in the Cambridge Companion to Jung, a volume which was published in the late 90s and which is about to appear in another year or so in a second edition. And a number of the chapters have been rewritten for the second edition. Mine hasn't, because I decided on rereading that I had really said what I had to say in the 90s, and I haven't, to be honest, been very directly involved with scholarship about Jung in recent years. But that volume is a good place to begin with Jung, because it has articles about Jung's clinical practice and his influence on art and history and so on from a variety of points of view, and several of the authors are themselves Jungian therapists.
Thanks for that
tip.
What
was also apparent, however, in that early conversation was that both men had some strange similarities of their kind of literary and artistic interest. They both discovered, for example, that they had, as students, read with great interest H. Rider Haggard's novel She, which is a very strange kind of fanciful account of how a young Englishman goes off to the Middle East and is followed around by people in disguise who turn out to be the agents of a priestess in East Africa who is the still living temple figure of pharaonic Egypt, who has bathed in a fire that has made her immortal. And the way Freud and Jung both later on said, we discovered we had deep interest in the problem of the eternal feminine and where gender differences come and how all of this transcends individual experience. And needless to say, Freud never writes that story in any detail crediting Jung, but it's there as a piece of background. And when Jung later on articulates his theory of the archetypes, it's quite clear that the notion of the anima, the kind of haunted image of the eternal feminine that every male personality is supposed to have within it, just as every female personality has an animus, which is some response to the maleness that is alien to females, that Haggard as an author had somehow captured the essence of this. That readiness to jump off into literature, of course, is something Freud does off and on throughout his life, with his reading of the Oedipus play and his reading of Hamlet and his interest in Dostoevsky and so on. And Jung, for his part, I think, uses writers like Haggard as evidence that there has always been concern in Western society with matters of ancient archetypal psychology that we more readily associate with the older civilizations, the civilizations of the Indian subcontinent and China and Egypt and so on.
Yes, that's really fascinating. You discuss that they each had kind of a psychodynamic motive for bonding to one another, that in Freud's case that he was actually pretty lonely and feeling isolated, and that and also you trace some possible, as you say, homoerotic motivations deriving from childhood and infantile impulses that would draw him towards Jung as a sort of a son figure, as well as just a male with whom he was very fascinated, where Jung, on the other hand, was somewhat alienated from his father and at least initially was projecting onto Freud very much of a father figure. Do I have that right, or is there more that you'd like to say about
David.
That?
In fact, I quote in the paper a remark that Freud makes about he was the first child of his father's second or third marriage. There's a little mystery about a woman named Rebecca, but Freud's mother, Amelie, gave birth to him out in rural, what's now, that became part of the rural Austro-Hungarian Empire. And then I don't remember exactly, but it's a little over a year later, she's pregnant again and she gives birth to a baby brother to Freud named Julius. And Julius was a sickly child and he died within about a year of life. And Freud later says, all of my male friendships have been affected by this early feeling that I had of some uncanny responsibility for my younger brother's death. And as a result, all of my close relationships, particularly with males, are somehow colored by this. In particular, my tendency to overvalue and then to feel rivalrous with a male colleague. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a fairly indirect and coded way of talking about homoerotic matters. But if we look more closely, Jung at one point says to Freud that, in fact, I can probably find the find the actual reference.
Yeah, I remember reading a quote that was pretty specific on that topic. I assume that's
yes,
the one you're
he
looking
says,
for.
Jung says to Freud at one point, I think this is early on, about 1907, "My veneration for you, Freud, has something of the character of a quote-unquote religious crush. Though it does not really bother me, I still feel it is disgusting and ridiculous because of its undeniable erotic undertone. This abominable feeling comes from the fact that as a boy I was the victim of a sexual assault by a man I once worshipped."
And you know, I had never heard that about Jung.
Nor had I, and it's very clearly there in the Jung correspondence. I think there's no doubt at all that Jung said it. But at least in the late 90s when I was researching this paper, I couldn't find much evidence that scholars had been able to elaborate on this or that Jung had referred to it anyplace else. But what it suggests is, and we ought probably for your listeners to just segue out to the whole concept of transference and countertransference, Freud is struggling to define what becomes one of the most important ideas in psychoanalytic therapy even today, and that is the notion that as you freely tell about all of your inmost feelings and your most personal history and anxieties, and as you're drawn by the associative process of psychoanalysis back to childhood, you begin to feel a kind of dependence on the adult to whom you're telling all this that is like the dependence you felt as a child toward the influential figures in your life. And in turn, being treated that way by a patient, being treated as if one were an idealized father or a lovely, nurturant mother or whatever, awakens in the psychoanalyst longings to be seen that way that are themselves childish in their basis. And from one point of view, orthodox psychoanalytic therapy is the treatment of the original psychological illness or difficulty, the neuroses, by creating circumstances that allow the patient to develop a new version of the illness by becoming neurotically attached to the analyst. And then the therapy frees the patient from that new illness, which can be seen directly because it's happening right there in the consulting room. And somehow that positive benefit makes it less likely the person will be similarly entangled in the future. Well, to put it a little too simply, I think I came to see this, like some of Freud's other relationships, as a pretty good example of the kind of toxic misunderstanding that can easily happen. Because no one is suggesting, to my knowledge, and I'm certainly not suggesting, that Freud and Jung had a sexual relationship, or even that they were very conscious in a regular way that they might have any erotic feelings for each other directly, but they were both very subtle clinicians, and of course they both read everything that Freud had written. And that tone creeps in. And so when Jung has finally really had it with Freud, we get after the trip to Clark University, and Jung is invited back, and on his second return he says, "They really liked my version of psychoanalysis, and I was able to make the sexual business less frightening." And Freud says, "Oh my God, there you go. You too are now being overwhelmed by your own resistances, and you're going to turn on me and offer a more palatable version of my theory." Well, Freud attempts to explain a little Freudian slip that Freud's made in a letter about, that Jung has made in a letter about even Adler's and Steckel, two of Freud's other disciples, "Don't consider me one of theirs," where he means yours. And Freud tries to interpret this, and Jung has clearly been getting very angry. And so he writes, "May I say a few words to you in earnest? I admit the ambivalence of my feelings toward you, but I'm inclined to take an honest and absolutely straightforward view of the situation. If you doubt my words, so much the worse for you. I would, however, point out that your technique of treating your pupils like patients is a blunder. In that way, you produce either slavish sons or impudent puppies, Adler, Steckel, and the whole insolent gang now throwing their weight about in Vienna. I'm objective enough to see through your little trick. You go about sniffing out all the symptomatic actions in your vicinity, thus reducing everyone to the level of sons and daughters who blushingly admit the existence of their faults. Meanwhile, you remain on top as the father sitting pretty. For sheer obsequiousness, nobody dares to pluck the prophet by the beard and inquire for once what you would say to a patient with a tendency to analyze the analyst instead of himself. You would certainly ask him, who's got the neurosis?" And at this point, things cool fast.
Okay, let me step in here because there's so many things that are being triggered by everything that you've said. And this last exchange that you've just shared, I mean, it seems like it got down to almost a sort of name calling, you know, where they're both accusing each other of being unconscious, that there's something going on in their unconscious that they're denying, you know, which is ultimately unprovable. And it seems to me that's, you know, that's kind of the weakness of psychoanalysis too, that, you know, you don't recognize this because you're unaware of it because it's in your unconscious.
Absolutely, David. In fact, for me as a non-clinician, this moment in the Freud-Jung relationship became yet one more example of the real miscarriages that can happen in psychoanalytic, collegial, and patient relationships. You're supposed to be thoroughly psychoanalyzed before you become an analyst. You're supposed to have known what it was like to develop your rational attachment to your analyst and recognize it for neurotic and infantile. And so that when you become an analyst yourself and people start to treat you as godlike and beautiful and brilliant, you realize that the image they have is a very idealized version of the balding, middle-aged, forgetful person that you in fact are. And these two men at this point are, of course, two of the most skilled people in the world at using those tricks.
Yeah.
And once the relationship degenerates to this level, it's sheer trouble. Now, I might say also that the biggest Freud news in the last year, at least if you were just reading the popular press, is the discovery in European hotel record of the entry of a supposedly married couple signed for by the husband, who signs Dr. Sigmund Freud Vienna und Frau. Well, the Frau in question was not Freud's wife, Martha, but her sister Minna, who was living with the Freuds at this point. And Jung was one of the people who suggested early on, and then again later in life, that when he first stayed with the Freuds, Freud's sister-in-law, who had a bedroom right adjacent to Freud and his wife, wanted his advice as a psychologist about her relationship with her brother-in-law, which Jung understood to be very close, i.e., read, quite possibly sexual. It seems increasingly likely that there probably was a sexual relationship, at least for a while, and so Jung had knowledge about Freud that would have embarrassed Freud very much. They also shared intimate details about their treatment of patients, and in some cases these were people they both knew. The most striking and complicated example is a young Russian woman named Sabina Spielrein, who was treated both by Freud and Jung and may well have had an affair with Jung. So once the name-calling starts, they have a lot of tricks up their sleeves and they have a lot of clinical evidence. Mm-hmm. And you can feel, I think, since I probably should have said at the outset, I do think these are two of the most interesting people ever to enter the field of psychotherapy and then to try to write about it academically. There is a kind of tragic side, whether you think it's Oedipal or not. There's a kind of tragic side to all of this because the result is that Freud and Jung personally can never really make a rapprochement. And Freudians and Jungians have stayed at arm's length from each other, I think, down to the present day. In Freud's case, you get little comments in publications that suggest that Jung keeps popping into his mind. He says at one point, this was an area, I think he's referring to the psychology of association, he says this was an area in which Carl Jung made some important contributions at a time when that researcher was content to be a mere psychologist and did not yet aspire to be a prophet. Mm-hmm. Freud also accuses Jung of being overly intellectualized. He says at one point, you have to remember that Jung is a Swiss, and it's a national characteristic of the Swiss that if you offer a Swiss a choice between two doors, one leading to paradise and one leading to an academic discussion of paradise, the Swiss will take the second door. So you get, at some level, you know, you could just relish all the nastiness. Unfortunately, and I think one of the reasons I decided I wasn't going to go back into this morass, there's a danger that what people carry away from this is, well, these guys were pretty screwed up, and I guess they weren't very good therapists and so on. And while I think that's an important set of issues to think about, these are brilliant and influential thinkers who are still of immense use to millions and millions of readers. And it's a great pity that so much was lost by this breakdown in collaboration. Jung goes on to do remarkable work on what we would now call the psychology of religion and the the fundamental circumstances of human societies all over the world. And there's some truth in his own characterization that Freud is a well-read post-Enlightenment European in terms of his scholarly origins, while Jung branched even early in life into Tibetan and Indian and Chinese and even to some extent Native American literatures as these became available in a way that is quite alien to Freud's way of proceeding. And it's been hard to bridge that gap because there's this legacy of the two camps distrusting each other at such a fundamental level.
Yeah, you know, that's really a good point that the two men are in a certain way of two different centuries or eras, because Jung resonates so much with people today on some of those themes that you were just discussing that it makes him very, very contemporary.
Absolutely. And in fact, one of the things that I regularly did in my long years of teaching at Haverford, where I taught a lot of Freud for an undergrad curriculum, including quite a unit even in intro, and I had a much, much smaller unit on Jung, and I would always spend, when we made the transition from Freud to Jung, a few minutes saying, I'm caught up in Freud in a way that I've spent a good many years reading a lot and rereading a lot of his published work and trying to think about his biography and so on. And I've had this experience often as I've gotten older. I come back to Jung. I own most of his fundamental writings, and I read Jung on a topic that Freud has already written about, and I'm struck by how fresh it is and what an interesting new approach it is and how even radically it helps to deepen one's understanding. And then at some point I discover that I don't quite understand what Jung is talking about, as if there's a part of my own background as a U.S. late 20th century trained social scientist that finds it. Freud is certainly no hero from a philosophy of science point of view with respect to many of his hypotheses and what he was willing to take as evidence. But Jung seems much more mysterious and mystical. Mm-hmm. But I think for those very reasons, he moves people deeply and in ways that clearly have been therapeutically helpful in terms of spiritual growth. And I think Jung's characterization of Freud and the Orthodox Freudians as far too obsessed with the first few years of childhood so that they don't have a fully adequate lifespan psychology, to say nothing of a psychology that transcends the individual life, whether you call it archetypal or not. All of that is conveyed, if people are listening to this who would like now to go out and learn about Jung, all of this is beautifully conveyed by a dream that Jung talks about in his Memories, Dreams, Reflections, which I think was done in the 50s and largely through interviews with someone. Now, we have no idea of knowing how well Jung remembers this dream after all these years, but it was a dream that supposedly Jung had when he and Ferenczi and Freud were on their way to America in 1909. And I won't read the dream, but I urge you to find a copy of Memories, Dreams, Reflections and read it. He's dreamt that he's in a large house, which he recognizes as his house. And of course, an analyst, whether they were a Jungian analyst or a Freudian analyst, might readily assume that the house represents in some way the psyche or the point of the dwelling place of one's personhood. Mm-hmm. And Jung's house is an immensely complicated place. It has a kind of a post-Enlightenment character in its upper floor, and it has a more sort of Baroque character as you go down, and then I think it has maybe a Romanesque basement, and finally there's a sub-basement with a trap door and steps leading down to something that apparently is of prehistoric origin, where there are some bones on the ground. And Jung tells this story and tells this really marvelous dream that I think any therapist would be fascinated by. And he says, all Freud wanted to know is whose bones they were. And Jung makes that story a parable about the fundamental failing of Freud, because Jung says, maybe the bones are the bones of somebody significant, you know, maybe that's it. But to reduce everything to that is exactly the worst application of Freudian type psychology. The question is, what does it mean to believe at a critical moment in my life? I become a disciple of Freud, I'm going off on an important professional venture, and things are opening up for me. What does it mean to have a dream in which I live in a vast mansion that touches all the phases of human history and has such wonders to explore. And here's my mentor teacher, and all he wants to know is, let's get those bones out of the basement and reanimate them and figure out what's going on.
Well, my recollection of that dream and the discussion of it, there's another dimension as well, which is that reportedly Freud wanted to interpret those bones as representing Jung's wish to kill his parents, and particularly Freud as a kind of parent symbol, if you will, so that it really represented Jung's unconscious hostility towards Freud, ultimately, whereas Jung tended to look at it in terms of those bones representing the bones of humanity, which in a way symbolize his whole fascination and quest to understand the past, its mythologies and its archaeological evidence and so on, and that it really represented the basement of the psyche.
Yes, and for Jung, that dream then becomes a wonderful example of the forward-looking character of dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes a nice metaphor for the larger issue that Jungians have continued to emphasize, that it's not a question of knowing your childhood as if you're going to discover a hidden crime. It's, in fact, finding out how we can take the past and see it as a preface to the future. What are the potentials here for growth and so on? And the dream itself is a kind of commentary then on Freud. And yes, you're quite right about the particular meaning of the bones. I mean, Jung says in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, admittedly many decades after the event, that at the time he knew where Freud was headed, knew what he wanted to hear, and he told him what he wanted to hear. And that was a sign, as he looked back on it later, of the beginning of his distrust. But of course, something else happened, which is a kind of standard part of Freud biographical lore. They were staying in a hotel before they boarded the ship from Europe, and the dinner conversation apparently got tangled up in a story that Jung had read in the newspaper. Someone had found preserved bones in a peat bog in northern Europe that seemed to reflect some prehistoric human remains. And he described Freud as surprising him, because Freud was interested in archaeology and had a big collection of antiquities and so on. Freud was very irritated by this and wondered why Jung found these corpses in the peat bog so interesting. And Jung and Ferenczi, according to Jung, become aware that Freud is really quite angry and upset, whereupon, to their amazement, he faints and slips off the chair. And Jung, according to the
Freud
story,
faints.
We do at least have the three of them, the three of their accounts, lifts Freud and puts him on a sofa or something. When Freud comes to, his first words are, "How sweet it must be to die." And then Freud himself becomes convinced that somehow he had misinterpreted, in his rational moments, I think he would have said, this is some sort of a death wish toward him.
Mm.
And interestingly enough, Freud then admits to, I think, both to Jung and to Ferenczi, that it was in that very hotel setting that he and his best friend from the late 1890s, Wilhelm Fliess, had a huge argument that had spelled the beginning of the end of their own friendship. And it was again a disagreement about the dearest psychological theories of each of them, where they basically, Freud argued that Fliess, who believed in organic cycles underlying psychology, cycles of 23 and 28 days, was simply doing a kind of mystical arithmetic that would allow him to answer any question. And Fliess turned on Freud and said, yeah, you just read whatever you want to into the dreams of your patients. So it may not be Oedipus Redivivus, but it's Fliess Redivivus. And again, this is so overdetermined by this time that once the two men have gotten their interpretations to this length, you can realize that it would have taken a lot of therapy by some neutral, brilliant therapist who didn't exist.
They'd have to be very brilliant.
Untangle this mess.
Yes. They'd have to be very brilliant. I wonder if you ever saw the movie Love at First Bite with Richard Benjamin and George Hamilton.
Yes, I did.
There's this wonderful scene, and I've referred to this in an earlier show as well, because this is one of my favorite comedy movies, where Richard Benjamin is is a psychiatrist, and George Hamilton is Dracula coming to New York City in the modern times, and they're competing for the affections of the ingenue, and whose name I'm blocking on at the moment. And so they're the three of them are around the dinner table, and George and George Hamilton, Dracula, and Richard Benjamin, the psychiatrist, are jousting for control of the situation, and they're trying to hypnotize one another. And so the one is saying, "You're getting very sleepy." And he says, "No, you are getting very sleepy. Your eyes are getting heavier." "No, your eyes are getting heavier." And it's just a hilarious send-up. And again, this has some of that same quality for me. Your unconscious is acting up. "No, your unconscious is acting up. You're projecting." "No, you're projecting." It's a very similar dynamic here. Now
I agree.
It's, Now the thing that they specifically fell out over had a lot to do with Freud's theory of infantile sexuality. And you quote a very interesting passage from Freud where at one point he's kind of doubting the evidence. His early theory is one in which actual child abuse, actual sexual abuse was being perpetrated on children by adults. So he thought this was what was coming up in the analysis. People were having memories of that sort of event. And at some point he begins to question that. And part of what he says in the passage that you quote, in essence, he kind of says, "Well, geez, this kind of perversion can't possibly be taking place with such frequency as this evidence would seem to suggest." But I'm just wondering, in light of what we know now about child abuse, is there a chance that, in fact, it was taking place with that sort of frequency?
That's a big topic. And in fact, again, I don't know how much stamina or sitz fleisch people are going to have for all of this, but from my
I insist that they
website,
listen,
which I think is linked into your is linked into the podcast site. I was fascinated myself to rethink that whole saga with Freud and the so-called seduction theory. By 1896, he's willing to argue that all of the psychoanalytic cases, whether it's 13 or 18. That he's been able to treat long enough so he's confident, have shown that behind the adult illness there's a, he calls it a pre-pubertal sexual trauma. It might be in childhood, it might be in the so-called latency period of the elementary school years, but before puberty. And by a year later, basically September, October of 1897, Freud is not rejecting the idea that sexual abuse occurs in childhood and that when it occurs it can often lead to neurosis, but he no longer argues that it's either necessary or sufficient. That is, the vast majority of neurotics, in the way Freud thinks about this after 1897, do not show any clear evidence of having been abused in a literal way, of having been victims of incest or assault. On the other hand, a great many people develop profound neuroses that can be treated by psychoanalysis, according to Freud, that in the course of the psychoanalysis, they begin to tell stories about caregivers, a father, a mother, a relative, or whoever, in which they begin to wonder if they've been sexually abused. And that leads Freud to write several of his very interesting short papers. My own favorite is one in 1899 called Screen Memories, where Freud, using a slightly disguised memory of his own from childhood, is able to show that one of his most vivid and important memories of playing in a field of dandelions with a little boy and a little girl and so on, a very vivid memory from his own first years of life, almost certainly couldn't have happened the way he remembers it. And he then begins to argue that the so-called repressed memory of abuse is not the gold that we thought lay down there in the unconscious. It's not the hidden explanation of the neurosis in the way that the solution of a Sherlock Holmes mystery would be. Rather, it's a complex of ideas that have lain next to gold, he says, that have been reflective of all those powerful, scary, erotic, and aggressive feelings of early childhood, and that you can't really easily tell the difference. Now, the letter you mentioned, it's a famous one. It's September 21st, 1897. It's quite remarkable. And again, I won't try to quote the whole paragraph, but it's in my papers and it's available in that Freud police correspondence. And the way I used to get to the bottom line with my students was, if Freud had been right that almost all neurosis was the result of sexual abuse in childhood, then his major impact on history might well have been that he would have helped us get concerned about child abuse early on, because the abuse then, the neurosis rather, would have been perfectly preventable, as Freud says, prevent child abuse, no neurosis, but uncurable. You can't literally undo the experience that happened. When he changes his mind, he loses a place in maybe the history of hygienic social work, and he also loses a little reference in the history of neurology, if you've been able to explain how exactly it is that sexual assault in childhood affects adult neurosis. But instead, he becomes the author of a whole new psychology, because everybody has an Oedipus complex. And Freud makes that argument with a move that I think, had he stayed friends with Jung, Jung and he might well have worked on together. Because what he says, and the reason we call it the Oedipus complex, he says to Fleece in 1897, in October, "I understand now why we keep watching this old Greek play. It's about a society very alien from ours. We already know the outcome. We know that Oedipus, you know, unknowingly has killed his father and had children with his mother. But it moves us, despite its alienness, because at a psychological level, it's not alien. We all were little Oedipuses." And then he goes on in the same letter to say, "Think of Hamlet. It's the same story, but it's as different from Oedipus Rex as Elizabethan society is from ancient Greek society. But basically, Hamlet's observation that conscience makes cowards of us all is a correct observation of the lasting influence of the Oedipus complex. We know that we have, in fact, had sexual and aggressive feelings toward our parents, and therefore we feel a kind of unconscious guilt." So that whole tangle. But to get to the literal truth, my own paper on this is titled "A Theory for the 90s, Freud's work on the seduction theory. And the reference I've tried to make in the paper is, it was clearly quite timely in terms of the way Freud was thinking in Vienna in the mid-1890s. It was also extremely germane to the way American clinical writing was being changed in the 1990s. Because estimates of the percentage of American children who've been subjected to sexual abuse, and of course you have to define your terms, went from a fraction of a percent to, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50%. The truth almost certainly lays somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. And I think, thanks to Freud, we now recognize that there's abuse in a literal sense, where, you know, children have been raped and physically assaulted and psychologically manipulated. But there's also a lot of simply bad, confusing, toxic caregiving that happens, that for reasons partly rooted in our early psychology and partly in the way society treats these things, make it hard for us to grow up into good adult relationships. And psychoanalysis is a part of asking that question. But I think most people, after what are sometimes called the memory wars in the 90s, with these vastly different claims about how frequent child abuse occurred, we now realize that it is extremely easy to be misled, as Freud himself realized he'd been misled by a patient's account that, yes, indeed, I think that my father, my kindly uncle, my babysitter might have done such and such a thing, and to take that as an established fact because the patient seems to remember it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know,
now,
what?
Again, what I guess one would have to say, as one looks at the whole course of critical writing about Freud and Jung, these are both men who had a deep interest in that topic and a lot of understanding of it, but they both seemed less aware than I think we would now say they should have been about the ways they were actually treating their own patients vis-a-vis these issues. I mean, Jung clearly had erotically charged therapeutic relationships with many patients and seems to actually have had sexual relationships with some of them. I don't know that anyone has ever made a plausible accusation that Freud engaged in anything that we would call sexual behavior with his patients, but certainly erotically charged entanglements are stock and trade.
Yes, yes. We're running long here, so we'll need to begin to wind down, but there are just a couple more things that I really want to touch on with you. You offer a quote from Freud that makes it sound like he was feeling pretty dispirited about the efficacy of psychoanalytic therapy. Let me read a portion of that quote. You quote, "The continual disappointment in my efforts to bring a single analysis to a real conclusion, the running away of people who for a period of time had been most gripped by analysis, the absence of the complete successes on which I had counted." Now, did he ultimately have that feeling, or was this written at an earlier stage? And
well, that is from that very famous letter in September of 1897, and what it suggests is, I think, and you have to sort of fill in the blanks, but I think you can do that plausibly. Freud seems to be saying, if I'm right that the psychoanalysis is reaching an earlier forgotten experience of abuse that the child has been unable to deal with, and that it's that residue, that we now call it a post-traumatic stress disorder, explains the current neurosis, then uncovering this ought to make the neurosis better. But at least in the context of that letter, he's unwilling to make that generalization. There are people for whom he seems to have uncovered this, but in some cases it doesn't help at all, or maybe frightens the patient away. And he also is saying, I begin to realize that I can come up with other explanations for why the person feels this way. He's not quite able to say yet in this letter, but he will say it in his publications later. It's very hard to tell the difference between a memory of a hitherto forgotten trauma and a memory that feels traumatic because it touches those childhood issues. There's no easy indicator of truth or falsehood in the unconscious. If by truth or falsehood we mean historical truth, what actually happened, the kind of truth that courts of law are concerned about. Psychological truth might lead us to say, this person acts in adulthood as if they had been treated this way in childhood. But we have to make that as-if statement, recognizing we can't convict anybody of child abuse on this basis because many of these accounts can be shown not to be true.
But the question is, how secure did Freud feel finally, ultimately, about the effectiveness not so much of his theory of personality and psychodynamics and psychopathology, but about psychoanalysis as therapy?
I think, David, we are about out of time, and the only honest response I can make is Freud sounds in most of his subsequent writings more confident than he does in this letter, but I myself am willing to psychoanalyze Freud to the extent of saying that confidence is somewhat exaggerated. Yeah, I think that a part of Freud knows from 1897 on that he's on somewhat shaky grounds with these assumptions and that his therapeutic successes are nowhere near as consistent as they would be if the Oedipal theory applied in a very literal, simple, straightforward way to every one of his patients. Now, there also are remarks that you can find sprinkled through Freud's private correspondence where he suggests that he's at times willing to acknowledge that he makes many mistakes with his patients and that basically every new theoretical insight, I'm paraphrasing it here, costs me a patient. That is, you can read the Dora case as, I really didn't adequately understand her transference relationship with me and, in parenthesis, my counter-transferential response to her. And as a result, I wasn't an effective therapist with her and she left early before she could have reaped the benefits of her therapy.
Okay, excellent. And speaking of transference and counter-transference, I have to compliment you on, there's one sentence here early in the article that I thought just in one sentence you deftly describe the psychoanalytic therapy process, and I'll read that sentence. It says, the patient falls for an analyst whose every move he or she will be capable of assimilating to the erotic and aggressive possibilities of the transference, and understanding the transference is the key to recovery from the neurosis. And that kind of sums up the whole process in a sentence. So I was struck by that.
I'm willing to stand with that statement by a younger version of myself.
Okay. And then finally, you conclude with what I thought was a very nice conclusion that really is pretty thought-provoking. You say, had Freud and Jung sustained their relationship for a few more years, psychoanalytic history would have been very different. There might have been a complete and coherent account of the requirements for psychoanalytic therapy and training. An adequate theory of female eroticism and gender might have had its beginnings. The interplay of sexual and aggressive emotions in human development would have been addressed explicitly instead of being deflected into tendentious anthropological speculation, and the spiritual aspect of life would perhaps have found a place in theory and in therapy. So, bravo, that's a wonderful conclusion. We can all dream about, boy, what if their friendship had continued and hadn't fallen upon the rocks? And like Freud and Jung, I think you and I could have a much longer conversation that would go all night long.
But I think, as we said at the beginning, this is the third go-round, and as we did long ago as graduate students, I'm confident we aren't going to run out of things to talk about.
Yeah, good, because I would really like to have you back here on Shrink Wrap Radio frequently. Now, just before we sign off here, I know you always got a lot of interesting projects underway. What are you working on now?
Well, I have had for the last, certainly the last third of my teaching career, I just really fully retired as of last year, three fairly persistent interests. One has been in psychodynamic psychology, particularly early Freud. A second has been in Morocco as a place and in Moroccan adolescence as a life stage. My wife, who's a cultural anthropologist, and I have worked together, co-authored a book on adolescence in Morocco. Susan is the first author. We've written many papers after it about youth and media and so on. And finally, by the mid-90s, I was intensely interested in the Internet as a psychological place, and I had some brilliant students in the late 90s and the turn of this century who studied social behavior on the Internet and in immersion and role-playing and so on. And what I've been doing recently, I'm back from Morocco, a place where I hope to spend a couple of months every year, working on a project that is called, in Moroccan Arabic, The Voices of Youth. And the idea is to use podcasting technology, very much like what you're using, as a way to allow young people to explore the topics that are of most relevance to their own lives, issues of family and school and job and courtship and so on, and to present this material in a way that makes it very, very easy, because Morocco, although it's a poor country, has excellent Internet connectivity now, and an awful lot of people carry cell phones and MP3 recorders around with them. So I'm trying to imagine and to involve myself in the beginnings of the immersion of a Moroccan Arabic oral literature on youth. And so I've been listening to Moroccan hip-hop music. I've been talking to young Moroccans. I've been reading blogs by people who speak Moroccan Arabic, both in Morocco and in Europe, where there are millions of young people who have Moroccan Arabic-speaking parents. And I can't claim that this work is explicitly Freudian or Jungian in any particular way, but it seems a wonderful opportunity for a personality psychologist to see something fascinating happen as a bunch of young people begin to explore their own lives.
And it sounds like great fodder for a future interview. So I'm going to invite you back at some point, and we're going to talk about that.
I would be delighted.
Okay. Doug Davis, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Many thanks, David. It is always a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with my old friend, Dr. Doug Davis. I let this one run longer than usual, and I hope you agree with me that it was worth it. Consequently, I'm going to skip my usual commentary. Let me know if you'd like to hear more from Doug in the future.
Hi, this is Fernando Blanco from Mexico City. You're on the couch, on a rock, on a boat, on a plane, with Doug today.
Thanks, Fernando, for that transition from our May contest. Sorry I haven't had any serious problems with ahs and ums for you to edit, as you have so generously done in the past. I'm going to keep it short and sweet. There are no new additions to our Frapper map. If you haven't done so already, be sure to check out our new website at shrinkwrapradio.com. You can now search by topic and by keywords, and you can also post comments there for me and others to read. Also, our feed has become so large that we had to drop the first 22 shows from the feed, but you can find them for listening or download in the archive section at Shrink Wrap Radio. Also, let me call to your attention to the In the Media menu item, where you'll find an interview of me just this past week by Shrink Wrap Radio listener Tom Barbalay. His podcast is about artificial life, and he interviewed me to see what perspectives I might bring to that topic as a psychologist. He's a very articulate and fascinating guy, and I recommend his podcast at biota.org. I also want to call your attention to an excellent interview about anger management with therapist Steve Shapps. You'll find it on my other podcast at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. And finally, I want to thank our sponsors, Podshow and GoDaddy. You'll find great GoDaddy discounts at shrinkwrapradio.com.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
That's Kevin Parker from Marlborough, New Zealand, who sent that transition in for our May contest. I've got back email to share, but we're already running a little long, so I'll save that for the next show. In the meantime, you can keep that email coming. I like it, even if I don't read it on the air. And once again, I want to thank my erudite friend, Dr. Doug Davis, for sharing his insights on the Freud-Jung letters. I'm not sure who my next guest will be. Actually, there's a strong chance that next week's show will consist of brief interviews from the International Association for the Study of Dreams conference at Sonoma State University. I've never tried anything like that before, so I think it might be quite interesting. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.